We begin our next session with Axel Thielmann. Axel Thielmann is a manufacturer based out of Hamburg and is a part of the Hacker Fulfill team, which develops computer games. And today he is going to be talking about Hacker Fulfill, which is a game that was developed in before the 33C3. And he would be talking about the updates and the new features that the game has. Over to you.
Okay.
Can we have a round of applause to for the speaker?
Thank you very much. Yeah. Hi, I'm Axel. I'm from Hacker Fulfill. We're a small indie game label from Hamburg. And over the last half year, we built a mobile game console, or started building one, and we'd like to show you. We're a bunch of retro developers. Three people are involved in the team. There is Rick, who unfortunately couldn't come today, but he does the main development environment coding. There is Christoph, who's sitting. Where is he sitting? Oh, he's sitting in the back, who does all the graphics and design aspects, and who also created this great presentation so you don't have to suffer through LaTeX slides built by me. I'm Axel, and I do mostly the hardware development and low-level coding. We've done a couple of releases, mostly retro games. You can see them on our website. They're all available for download. Some of them you can even play online. And this is Puzzle Cave, for example. And I think that's Fufflebuy on the right. Yeah, we all grew up in the 80s with 80s hardware. Some of us with home computers. Some of us with game consoles. And we always loved these systems. And of course, mobile games were around at that time, but they weren't really that great. They were kind of clunky, really bad battery life. They were very expensive. You couldn't get many games, and sometimes if you wanted one, you actually had to order one from Japan. So I never really had a mobile game system. This might also be because there wasn't a mobile C64, but yeah. Fast forward 30 years later, so much has changed. Like, electronics has changed a lot. So much interesting stuff coming with the Internet of Things and small electronics now. The maker scene has evolved, and suddenly you have access to really professional manufacturing for DIY products or projects. Of course, maker spaces have happened, and suddenly you can just go to your friendly neighborhood makerspace and use a laser cutter or a 3D printer. So these days you can do projects that were completely impractical and really expensive just 10 years ago. And also retro gaming is really booming. There's lots of DIY projects out there, all kinds of things, people building their own systems. There's a bunch of crowdfunding campaigns out there who really get really big funding. And even all the old big companies like Nintendo and Sega and Atari are coming back and re-releasing some of the old systems. And they're really well received for the Nintendo systems. They usually sold out before they're even on the market. Yeah, well, at the end of last year, we sat at the Attractor Makerspace, and we kind of just started talking about all these systems coming out and what we liked about them. And many months later, long story short, we decided, hey, let's build our own. Let's build the mobile game console that we always wanted and never had. And we kept talking and kept talking. And yeah, another few hours later, we had all these design sketches. Some are more serious than others. I really like the multiplayer ones. And there's also, that's one of my favorites, where you connect your game console to your mobile phone over an audio cable and can maybe just download games from the audio track of a YouTube video like you did with audio tapes back in the 80s. So we had a lot of crazy ideas. And we're pretty hooked on the thing. But what did we want to build? We wanted to build a mobile game system. but on really more modern hardware. Just really see where what we loved about these systems, where this could be in 2017. We wanted to add lots of sensors that maybe have never been tried on a game system. I really love sensors. I'm a hardware guy, so this is kind of my thing. And we wanted to build it as completely open hardware and open source. So building a system like that in mass production is really quite complex or difficult. So what we went with, what we wanted to make a spaceable design. Basically saying if you have the PCB and you have a little bit of soldering experience, you can just go to your makerspace and the design will be done in a way that you can just use a laser cutter or a 3D printer, and after a weekend or so, you have your own system. But this would also enable people to remix the system. If you have access to all the design files, all the stack down, all the developers, everybody who has access to that can also build the console they always wanted. Or maybe just change some little thing that always bugged them about it. But most of all, hello? Most of all, we wanted a true retro system. I've been saying this word quite a lot. What does it actually mean? For us, retro was a lot more than just like games with big pixels and flashy colors. And sometimes there's even a flash game behind it. So now, this is not what we wanted. And also, retro games usually focus on the player, on the experience the player had, and typical game mechanics, and a certain aesthetics. But in the 80s, owning a computer was also being a developer, coding for this. This was right in the manual. The C64 manual starts and really immediately tells you how to do low-level programming. And there was a whole development side to retro gaming that we were interested in and that we wanted to keep alive. Because the old hardware systems slowly but steadily die, they just get put in a museum where you can't code on them. And all the old developers, well, they don't really die, but they move on to other things. And so there's a whole developer community, and that we wanted to help build forward and see where this is going. So what's retro for coders? For us, it was like simple interfaces, simple graphics functionality that you can get into easily. Small dev teams, like in the 80s, when computer games were usually done by one, two, maybe three person, and we wanted to have a manageable project size. So not like today when you have tens or hundreds of people working on a big game. So what we were aiming at was kind of a one developer, one weekend kind of thing. If you had an idea for a game that you could start and finish within time. And one of the really important things for us in retro was restricting complexity. And back in the 80s, all these systems were really, really restricted. But that was not a conscious design decision, at least not for the game. It was a restriction because of financial reasons or practical reasons. This was consumer electronics, usually aimed at kids, and you had to be able to buy the whole thing for maybe a few hundred dollars. So these systems were really, really restricted, but purely for financial reasons. But this also, this kind of restriction became sort of the identity of these old systems. And it also led to a sort of recognizable aesthetics for each of those platforms. For some of the platforms, you can see a screenshot and you don't know what game is it, but you can tell from the screenshot which platform this is, simply because that's the graphics engine of this system. To give you a bit more of a shard metaphor for us, like we felt retro gaming was like going camping. Because for camping, you just get your stuff, start at point A, go out into nature and enjoy that, and you accept that the temporary discomfort of sleeping in a sleeping bag in a tent. But you really, you're out enjoying this, and it's not really about getting to point B. and the gear that you take, tent, stove, backpack, when this was invented, this was also not invented for fun. It was invented so people had shelter and food and like could get from A to B. And these days, camping is a lot nicer, a lot more technology in this. We have self-pitching tents, all kinds of high-tech materials. And before you know it, you're on a camp with thousands of strangers and power and Ethernet in your tent. So the experience has been cleaned up a little bit. And this is sort of what we wanted to do with retro development. We wanted to keep the core alive, but slowly try to clean it up and try to remove the things that were just annoying. For example, weird hardware behavior that was just there because the graphics chip needed some data, like it was on the C64. We also wanted easier interfaces and offer a bunch of modules that especially newcomers could use that would sort of enable to use a certain development technique rather than having to develop everything your own. And we removed assembler. So, of course, all these old systems, they used assembler coding, and you had to learn that. And removing this is a bit of a contradiction, but we felt, yeah, that maybe this would put the learning curve a little bit too high. And what we also wanted, we wanted the system to be inviting to play around with. And this meant choosing the right level of complexity. And we wanted to do this on hardware, for software, and for graphics. For graphics, this means low resolution, fewer colors. Because even for a pro designer, if you have to pixel something that's thousands of pixels per side, that's quite a lot of work, and this can put you off, especially for a hobby project, or you will just never finish it and toss it aside, and yeah, so you would never get your game finished. For the software, it meant having a modular OS, but also restricting the number of modules, the number of interfaces, and make the system a little bit easier to learn. So, and also for the whole design, we wanted it to be not so uniform and polished and like perfect, because this might intimidate people who are really just learning about this. We wanted a little bit rough. So, yeah, the people can just take it and do whatever they want with it. So we wanted to have a good number of parts on all these levels. Once you have that, something interesting happens. If you restrict the complexity, the newcomers will find it easier to start with the system, and the people who are more advanced will really see this as a challenge. What can I do with this? Within this restriction, within these rules? This is kind of like board games, like chess. These games have been around for literally thousands of years, people are still discovering new things, and as these board games really become a place of competition just comparing what you can do with this. And for the C64, for example, now it's almost 40 years since it's been out, and people are still discovering new things and really still improving graphics. So this is what you get for the pros if you restrict complexity. Yeah, but on to a few more specific goals that we want to have. We didn't want to clone, directly clone anything. No emulators, no big OS below it, just the game OS on hardware. We wanted completely do new hardware and software, co-developed in iteration so we could figure out what would work and what didn't. We wanted a small, low-resolution screen, and we couldn't really agree on the type of system or the era of the system that we wanted to base this upon. And again, this was a good thing because now it's a bit of this and a bit of that, and it has to be recombinable. So we settled on a TFT of about 3 inches, 240 by 160 resolution, 16 fixed colors, meaning you could guess just these 16 colors. You can't change them in any way, plus one color, which is transparency. We want a true 60 hertz screen refresh rate, so nice, smooth scrolling, nothing jerky, like it was on the, again, on the C64. For controls, we settled for the usual D-pad and buttons combination for now. Well, this is tried and true, and people intuitively know how to use it. And for graphics functionality, the starting set was two modules. One was the was a tile engine with 8x8 pixels, and the other one was a sprite engine with 32x32 pixels. Yeah, so a tile engine. This is probably one of the most iconic graphics techniques that came out of these old systems, and it's really quite simple. You start with what's called a tile sheet, which is just a bunch of small rectangular graphics, like here, and then you sort of stamp them together to form a larger graphics. And if you do it in this top-down manner, you get this really this sort of checkerboard structure, and a lot of similarity, and you get a very recognizable aesthetics. On the other hand, if you do it bottom-up, which, as far as I know, was done for Maniac Mansion, they started with full-drawn pictures and then had a program figure out what the optimal tile set would be and just calculated that and put that into the game. And there you can see that this is really mainly an efficiency technique, because it saves a lot of time copying stuff between places in RAM, which you don't really have on a low-power system. It saves RAM, and it saves floppy. A game like Maniac Mansion would not have fit on the few floppy sites that it was if this were really bitmaps. Oh, it's back. The other one is sprites, and for sprites, that's even more just an optimization technique. The graphics chip will allow you to program small rectangular pieces of graphics, and you can just program a register where you want that sprite to be, and it'll take care of handling the transparency because it's not rectangular, blend it with the background, and once you move it, remove it from there and put it somewhere else. And a sprite engine would usually also handle collision with other sprites or with a background, so you know when, you might be hit by a projectile or touching a monster or something. And again, you can all do all this in software. There's really no reason other than performance to do it in hardware. Okay. So. Building hardware. What's the basic structure? Most of these old systems have a sort of not very remarkable CPU. Usually, these were selected for price, and the heart, the identity of systems like that was really in the graphics chip. And if you really build a game console, what all these companies did was they developed a specialized IC. And then attached it over to an exposed system bus to the CPU, and so the CPU could just write or had the interface to the graphics chip in main memory, and it was easy from a program to just you write to a specific memory location, and stuff would happen for the graphics engine. This of course only will work if you already know that you will sell a few millions of units. So this was kind of ruled out for us. There's another way to use reconfigurable hardware like FPGAs, where you can really build your own graphics chip, but this would have made the hardware really expensive because FPGAs are quite expensive, and also they are sort of hard to develop for, and it takes a long time, and we wanted to iterate quickly to try out concepts. So what is left is basically doing everything in software, which is a bit boring, or go look for a microcontroller that has modern graphics functionality and see if we can use this. Yeah, and this was about half a year ago at the CCC Congress in Hamburg. And we just wanted to start building, so we selected this, something that would roughly fit. We wanted a very, very fast microcontroller, so we had enough compute power to do whatever we wanted to try out. We wanted to wanted support for good low-level graphics and a TFT interface. And this is what we went for. That's a board with an STM32F7, which is one of the fastest microcontrollers that ST makes. And they sell these in these very nice, they're called Nucleo boards. They are really well engineered, have lots of interfaces, and they're really, really cheap. The cheapest ones are about 10 euros, the biggest ones are about 30 euros. And yeah, these are nice to develop with because if you put them to the side, you almost have the form factor like you would need for a mobile game system. And it has a connector here. So we thought, yeah, well, for the first prototype, let's just put another PCB on top of it with controls and a screen, and we're good to go. And the microcontroller on it is very powerful. It has it's around 200 megahertz, half a megabyte of RAM, 2 megabytes of flash, and it has a lot of interesting peripherals. Looking at the documentation, so we wanted to try these out. And the first peripheral is called DMA2D. And DMA2D is really just dedicated circuitry to copy bits, like rectangular bits of graphics between parts and memory. And you can do this either like in the top line, just copy graphics data from someplace to someplace else, or you can do it with online conversion. And if you do it like this, the source memory really is just an index into a color lookup table. And the DMA2D circuitry will automatically convert this into the actual graphics data. And it can also handle transparency and format conversion and all kinds of stuff. And it's really fast. We did a speed check like at the camp a few days ago, and it turned out we could do like 240,000 copies per second. So yeah, that's very powerful. We thought, okay, we're probably good with this. Let's just use this. And the rectangular screen parts, I think this was mainly meant for having windowing systems, so your rectangles would be windows or icons moving around. But hey, we just wanted rectangles, we wanted a tile engine. This is a perfect match, and it will also give us the palette indexing in hardware for free. So this was a really good fit. And the second peripheral that's really nice was the LTDC, which means LCD TFT display controller, and it's really just a regular graphics controller to attach a TFT, but it's integrated into the microcontroller, and this means that the timing is synchronous, meaning the display controller runs synchronous to the main CPU, and the CPU can know exactly how many cycles have passed. What the display controller is doing, and like it was with the Atari 2600, the proverbial racing the beam, you get something like this directly if it's directly integrated. So we had this nice timing integration, and this would allow you to use a bunch of techniques that the old systems had. For example, updating the picture when you know it's currently not anywhere where the graphics controller is drawing. Or you can get an interrupt at a certain line and switch graphics modes while the screen is drawing and having a different graphics mode for the playing field than, for example, for the menus. So yeah, this was also a great fit. The interface is something that's called a raw interface, which means you have to continuously pump out data. If you stop for any time, the screen will go white immediately. Screens like that are really just practical if you have an integrated display controller and you have 24 data lines, which is just RGB 8-bit color. Synchronization, two lines for horizontal and vertical, and a clock. And these run at around 10 megahertz. Ah, okay. So, next thing we needed was a screen. And like I said, to use the LTDC, we needed this raw interface, not something with an integrated display controller. And it turns out buying screens or sourcing screens is really kind of a pain in the ass. First of all, people are pretty spoiled by mobile phones. They expect really nice screens, high DPIs, very nice colors. And for most non-trivial products, screens are custom-made, so you cannot buy them. There's a lot of generic screens out there, but they are not very nice, and they're usually targeted towards a very specific product. And all the small screens, they were made for initially for small mobile phones, for very low-power mobile phones. And since mobile phones are very low power and don't have a display controller, all these small screens had a display controller integrated but didn't offer the raw interface. So this kind of, we couldn't use the really small screens we had to compromise a bit. But in the end, we found something we bought something that just was available and reasonably well documented, meaning in English and not Chinese. And we could just work with it and, then see. Yeah, so we started prototyping at the Congress in Hamburg, and it was really just about testing the LCD interface. This is the setup we had at the Congress. So it's really just a bunch of cables attached to the screen. It took us almost 3 days until we had the whole software setup running. But in the end, we had this, the graphics engine was running, and we're pretty happy about this. So we started building the OS structure, and overall, well, at the end of the Congress, we knew, okay, this hardware platform was going to work. We can build a prototype based on this. And this is what the first prototype looks like, at least half of it, because, like I said, it's a shield that goes onto one of those Nucleo boards, and combined, it looks like this. It has a nice height, and it's really it already feels like a mobile system. The PCB itself, if I turn it around, this is the user-facing side. The screen is currently missing, but you have your D-pad on the left, buttons on the right. And here, this is actually not that much interesting circuitry. It's mainly power. It's a charging controller for the battery, so the whole system would already be completely mobile. The battery also powers the Nucleo board below. It generates three voltages for the TFT controller and the backlight and the system itself. But what we already added was a cartridge slot. This is a repurposed SD card slot with a lot of pins, but we really wanted cartridges because the old systems had cartridges. We added a second screen connector, so we thought, oh, maybe it would be awesome to have a screen that only your opponents see when you play against them. And a bit of debug circuitry. So we had the prototype after 3 months or so. It was working nicely, and at the same time we were building the OS, or starting to set up the overall structure. Since we figured, okay, there's probably going to be more than one prototype, let's have a hardware abstraction layer at the as low as possible, so the actual operating system sits on top of that, and we can compile this for different hardwares. But it also turned out that once you have that and you have the abstraction, you can put the game OS inside your development environment, and maybe have an emulator or something like that. For the game interface, we initially started with C, a sort of restricted, cleaned up version of C, meaning no libc, and you would only have access to the functions that the game OS explicitly gave you, and at least the OS wouldn't make you use dynamic memory or pointer arithmetic or things like that. So the functions were designed in a way that it's easier to start with a development environment. But once we had that, we thought, okay, maybe we just want to put a Lua scripting engine on top of this, where you have the same functions. And you can choose either to go with C or with Lua. You would have the same programming model, the same functions. But Lua also offers a few nice data types, again, to get you coding more quickly. So we had hardware, we had software, and we needed something to look at. And the first thing, of course, is a palette of colors, because, like I said, we had 16 fixed colors. And yeah, I'm a hardware guy, so these are the colors made by Christoph, and I hope I can reproduce this correctly. The colors, well, they start with the you need colors, for example, for grass and for trees and for people walking around. So it would be nice for making jump and run games, but also since it's restricted, you want the colors to be easily mixable and blendable, and easily to arrange them in a way that you can go from light to dark. And you can see the darker it gets, the bluer it gets, and so the whole palette is kind of geared towards the blending effects that you use when pixeling data. Or when pixeling images. What we put on top of this, of the 16 slot palette, is a 256 slot palette called a permutation palette. And this also can only index these 16 colors, so you would have necessarily have doubles. But what this allows you is to change the index during a game and do all kind of palette effects, like palette rolling, phasing parts of the image in and out. And this was also a technique that was extensively done in the 80s and 90s. There's awesome videos on YouTube where people demonstrate what they could do with a single static image and just modifying the palette. After we had that, we needed game assets. Game assets being everything that the developer wants to put in the game apart from code, graphics, sound. And until we had our proper tool, basically we just defined a graphics format, which was based on C code, so we could immediately feed this to the compiler. And we just took two existing tools. This is a tool called Graphics, Graphics 2, which is based on Deluxe Paint, a famous pixeling tool, a graphics tool. Hey! And we just, they're both open source, and we just took that, added our save game, so now we already had a tool to create tile sheets and just render them out and put them in the source tree. And to make maps, this is a tool called Tiled, and this one is so flexible we didn't even have to change it. We could directly just load the tile maps into it, just create the maps, save it out. It has a few generic formats, and basically you just have to put curly braces at the beginning, at the end, and you can immediately feed it to compiler. But yeah, these were just a quick hack to get us going. What we really wanted was an integrated development environment. And this is a screenshot of an early version of the Hacker tool. This is sort of the command central for all the parts of the creation process. In the middle, you have your source code window. At the top, there's sort of not a full emulator of the system, but it's a possibility if you have created animation to try things out or to try out the maps. So it's kind of a simulator of parts of the game engine. And on the left is music tracking, and on the right you can pixel tiles and sprites, and also do animations and see how those work. This is where we currently are. Here you also can see why I didn't show you that much footage of the console itself. This is just a camera artifact, so sorry for the flickering. But after the talk, if you like, you can see it on the system directly. The tile engine is working, the sprite engine is working. For the tiles, we currently support one layer of tiles. The map can be any size, like a lot bigger than the screen, and it will smoothly scroll. And in the next few months, we want to add multi-layer tiles with zooming, so you can have a sort of a depth effect, like it's often used in jump-and-run games. That's called parallax scrolling. We want animated tiles, so maybe the grass on your map is automatically moving, or there's a waterfall in the back. This will be the state of the tile engine when it's, well, not completed, but this is what we're aiming for the first prototype. The sprite engine is also moving again. At the moment, you can display any number of sprites, so it's not really restricted. We still have to add collision and animation for the sprites. So for the second prototype, for the next revision of the hardware, what do we want to add? Like I said, we really like the idea of having cartridges, and this will definitely be part of the second prototype again. It's not really needed because memory is so cheap, you can really just put everything on one flash, but we really like the experience of having one game per cartridge and picking it up, putting it in, and you immediately can start the game and you don't have to scroll through lists and lists and lists of ROM and look at ROM 3825. So this is kind of a player experience thing that we wanted. And again, it turns out that modern microcontrollers, you can just attach flash and it will show up in main memory. For this controller, even, I think, up to 6 different flash images or flash ICs. So we could just put that bus on the cartridge connector, and we would really have a behavior that's very similar to what the old systems did in the 80s. We also put an extension bus on there based on I2C and SPI. And for the microcontroller world, if you have these two protocols, you can basically put anything there. These are extremely versatile protocols. So again, earlier cartridges, it was not uncommon for a cartridge not to only supply game code, but also to maybe extend RAM, add a coprocessor, sometimes even really replace the CPU, and do all kinds of crazy extensions, because the cartridge slot usually was just the system bus, and the cartridge could do whatever the hell it wanted. Next that we want to add is networking, right? Wireless networking. And we want some kind of broadcast medium, similar to Ethernet basically, but no routing, and no point-to-point coupling, no linking or anything like this. What we're aiming for is simply all the Hackerboy systems that are within radio distance of each other immediately and automatically see each other, and this will show up in memory in menus, and you say, okay, I want to join a game. And this is sort of like think of it like LAN party type network of the 90s. And we will probably use Bluetooth 5 for this, mainly because it's new and interesting, but it also has an extended radio range, and it comes with Bluetooth mesh, so you can connect even more systems together. And what you get for free with Bluetooth is connection to mobile phones, so you can have a companion app and download new games and what have you. Maybe you've noticed what's currently missing is sound. And yes, we want to add sound to the next prototype, but this is one of the aspects that we're still kind of unsure about. For the C64, for example, sound, the sound chip, like the glorious SID, the instruments were roughly modeled after analog synthesizers, and we didn't really directly want to clone this. We wanted to take it a step further, but we haven't really figured out what this step would be. What we would really like to do is explore aspects of generative sound, generating instruments, generating music tracks. Because generative programming was also big in the early games, simply because there was not much memory, and this was again a technique to save memory. For the interface for the player, we want to add Bluetooth audio, so you can use your existing headphones if you have one. And well, since we're not Apple, you're also getting a headphone jack. Because we really want to try out and do this games over audio in a YouTube video soundtrack kind of thing. Yeah, the second prototype with these subsystems added, this will no longer be based on the dev board, but be one big PCB with all the ICs on it. It'll come with the first prototype with a proper enclosure and the mechanics for a D-pad. Like I said, Bluetooth. We'll probably want to add all the sensors that we can find. Mobile gaming has introduced lots of sensors to games simply because smartphones usually have a lot of sensors. And I'm still looking for a game idea where I can add the temperature or the air pressure to the way the game behaves. This is kind of a thing for me. And we hope to have this done for the next Congress, the CCC Congress, but we don't really have a fixed roadmap at the moment. So how do we get this design, this console out to you, out to people? And yeah, like I mentioned, it'll be open hardware, and we wanted it to be maker-spaceable. But we often get asked, like, okay, when's the crowdfunding campaign? When can I buy this? To this, we usually say we're not really in or out. We're not focusing on manufacturing, on serial manufacturing at the moment, simply because these requirements would sort of restrict the game design extremely, and either you can focus, at least for a DIY product, either you can focus on manufacturability and keep the price down, which means that you're going to use all kinds of cheap Chinese bad mechanics, and it'll not really be a fun console to work with. Or you could just do the design and then afterwards see how much you can boil the design down to make it manufacturable and affordable. And the second way really could work, simply because once you're looking at thousands or tens of thousands of units, you get access to whole other development platforms, and suddenly a microcontroller doesn't cost like 10 or 15 euros anymore, but 2 or 3 or something. So while we're not aiming for this, a goal of going to maybe 30, 40 euros for components plus PCB at least doesn't seem out of the question. Yeah, well, what's next? There's no real conclusion to this talk, basically, because we're just getting started. We just have the first prototype. We wanted to do a few iteration with the OS and the hardware and see where this is going. And we're also trying to take it slow, because this is really a lot of work. Halfway through the year, we realized, okay, we're actually building a game console, and DIYing a game console is in no way less work. So we don't want to burn out, really just keep on going as we feel like it, and maybe this will take another year or 2 or 3, we don't know, but we're hugely enjoying building this. And we hope others will join and work with us on this platform together. So this was mainly what I wanted to show you, how far we've got. We invite you to keep up. We'll post things on Twitter quite often. You're welcome to follow us. We have a website. This will be relaunched. Currently, it contains mainly a few pictures from the development, but we'll relaunch the website and put lots of articles there and release all the design files, and then, see where this can go. Okay, I hope we have some time for questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Axel. It's always interesting to see when an idea that took place in a gathering like this comes back as a prototype, and it makes me really happy also, especially to see the retro game console. Any questions? Yeah, we have we You seem to have some questions.
I do a statement and a question. Thank you for this awesome presentation. The graphics were fabulous.
Thank you very much. But this is all goes out to Christoph. Like, if it were me, you would have got LaTeX slides. I'm really happy myself.
How many hours did he put into that presentation?
All of them.
How many?
I haven't left my chair at the village much this year. But yeah, we really enjoyed that.
You're using Lua as a programming language?
Yeah.
What about BASIC?
Actually, the design is open enough so that you could, like I said, remix it. This is what we want. If for everybody who's coming here said, why not? I'm saying, yeah, come on, do it. The interface is there. So another option would be MicroPython, I guess. BASIC, there's a few other languages. We kept the interface intentionally clean and easy to work with. So if your scripting engine is sort of modular and can run on a microcontroller, that you can just plug it on top of it. So we're open to all kinds of new languages.
Amazing project and amazing presentation. I'm wondering, you were talking about constraints. What are you aiming in terms of memory and in terms of CPU? Right now it seems like a super overpowered system.
Yes. One of the next things will be to put a real-time OS underneath it so we can really enforce this. We haven't really figured this out. Maybe something like 32 or 64 kilobytes of game code, like compiled game code, plus game assets. At the moment we just have sort of a thumb value, and then we'll just try what you can do with like what kinds of games you can actually develop at different levels. Also what we want to do is have the thing remixable ourselves, meaning all the modules should be recombinable in what we call personas of games. So you could recombine them to something early 80s Atari 2600 style, or something theoretical, even less powerful, or go early 90s, have multiple scrolling layers, so we will probably develop one or two of those personas of our own, and then invite everybody else to remix the console in the way that they want it. Okay, thank you. If you want to see the prototype, you're welcome to come up front after the talk, and we'll be at the Attractor Village tonight and probably for the whole day tomorrow. So you're welcome and try this out, and thank you for coming again.